We have today a special guest on WIDELP, Fred Edwards, who's going to talk to us about his time with humanists in India. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you.
When was your last trip and what were you? You were in India on four different occasions?
Yes, I was. And my last trip was in the 1990s. And I was executive director of the American Humanist Association at the time that I led my various tour groups in India. I would get together a number of people who wanted to visit India and visit the many humanist and atheist locations in India. People don't think of that. Hmm. They think of mystical India and all mm-hmm. of those sorts of things. But it turns out that I have a lot of friends in India who are connected with various organizations, and as a result, we could tie in visits to them and their work to see what humanists and atheists are doing in India to make a difference.
And who went on these tours?
I had an interesting cross-section of people from across the United States and Canada who went on these tours, people who were the wealthier class, people who were working class, because I tried to keep my tours affordable. And yet, at the same time, I made sure that we stayed in top hotels because it's quite a culture shock going to India. And what might be acceptable to the people in India as far as a hotel goes, since it's such a shock in parts of India to travel around, you kind of need that oasis to retreat to and have a little bit of the usual comforts you're used to. So I planned it that way, and it worked out very well.
And were these under the auspices of the American Humanist Association?
Yeah, the tours were under the auspices of the AHA, and the hotel prices were actually quite low, even though I was using 4- and 5-star hotels.
Mm-hmm. And when was your first trip?
Oh, that was, I don't remember the exact year, but it was in the 1980s, and it was in connection with a meeting of various groups within India to have a conference to talk about humanism and free thought in India. And it was an effort to get all the different groups in India talking to each other and to also meet with people from other countries. And so I was giving a paper at that conference. And in connection with that, I built a whole tour around the fact that we would go to that conference. And then after the conference, we would travel elsewhere in India.
And where was the conference held and what other locations did you go to?
Well, the conference was held in what was then called Bombay, now called Mumbai. And it was held at a center that was run by I think it was called the Indian Renaissance Center, which was connected with the Indian Radical Humanist Association. Hmm. Now, they like to put radical in their name because they're contrary to party politics. They're against party politics. So by being radical humanists, they're sort of stepping outside the system and saying, look, we're promoting our humanism as a way of opposing colonialism and opposing the kind of party politics that just divides the country into warring camps and doesn't focus on the issues. So they were political, they were socially conscious, and they were philosophically humanists.
What were the chief issues that were of their local concern?
A lot of the issues had to do with charitable-related projects. You had, and still have, a problem in India of overpopulation. And so they were teaching birth control to the people in the slums of Bombay at that time. And there was a woman, Indumati Parikh, Dr. Indumati Parikh. She was head of both the Indian Renaissance Center and the Indian Radical Humanist Association. She was the president. And she ran a clinic for women in the slums, and it provided women with contraception information. It provided women with things that would take care of their basic needs. It helped them with maternal care, provided them a lot of information. And her effort gained funding from international funding sources like the Ford Foundation and so on. But in order to get Ford Foundation money, she had to underplay in her promotional material the fact that she was doing her bit to promote birth control and abortion that those were things that the Ford Foundation didn't want to be officially identified with. So they were supportive of women care and things like that. And the attitude of the humanists in India is that if you elevate the women, you elevate everyone, because the women oftentimes spread the ideas through the village. Very often the grandmothers were ideal for spreading the image of birth control. That resulted in oftentimes the wives and the grandmothers talking to the men to get them to use condoms and other forms of birth control, because putting it all on the woman didn't work very well. But if the women in the village could lean on the men, then the men would start to comply. And it was a very effective system. They also had effective ways of illustrating their work. Another group on the other side of India, on the east coast of India, in Vijayawada, called the Atheist Center, they were very active in promoting population growth control as well. And what they would do is they'd go into the villages and they would do these demonstrations that anybody could understand. They would take these dolls and say, okay, this is a mama and a papa, and then they have this many children, and then each of these children have this many children. And before they get too far, they've got the table full of all of these dolls, and the people sort of see. They go, oh, I see. And it would sort of give them an aha experience, and that was one of the effective ways they spread that information. And they call themselves the Atheist Center, not necessarily because they don't want to identify with humanism or because they want to be particularly radical. They call themselves the Atheist Center because there's something about Hinduism. They want to co-opt everybody. Whatever god you believe in, they can just add that god to their pantheon and you're okay. Polytheism works like that. It's very tolerant. Well, these humanists wanted to make sure that nobody co-opted them, that they were not Hindus. And the only way you cannot be a Hindu is to say you don't believe in God. That's the only thing that'll work, because they'll add your God, whatever it is. But if you don't have any God, and they'll say they're humanists too. The Hindus will say, oh yeah, we're humanists, we love humanity, blah, blah, blah. So this was a way of differentiating themselves by saying, well, we're atheists. Mm-hmm. And they ran a very strong charitable program. They had a hospital, they had schools. They had schools scattered all over Andhra Pradesh, which is one of the states in India. Mm-hmm. And they had medical programs. They had science programs that they took out to the public and taught them about science. They debunked what were called the God men, people like Sai Baba, by showing how all their tricks are done. And by this means, they, as they would say, uplifted the people. That was their expression for it.
Now, are these tricksters religious leaders within Hinduism? Or?
Well, they're kind of in the same way that you have independent healers and evangelists, mm-hmm, in this country, in the evangelical tradition and in the charismatic tradition. So you have in Hinduism, there's no like Pope of Hinduism. So, mm-hmm, everybody's on their own. So these priests or godmen show up and they come in and, oh, they're going to heal you. And look at all of the amazing things they can do with sleight of hand, which they say isn't sleight of hand, but is in fact the power derived from God. And so then they are charlatans. They're independent charlatans. So the general focus of the Atheist Center then is a kind of humanism that is engaged in social service. In this country, in the United States, we're used to having the government provide many social services. But in India, that falls to a lot of private charities and religious organizations. So the Atheist Center is very active in social service. They have a battered woman's home. They have a hospital, I mentioned. They teach animal husbandry and other things to people. They teach them careers, as well as giving children education in their schools. A lot of the basic things that we take for granted in this country because government provides them, the atheists at the Atheist Center provide for the people in Vijayawada, where they're located. They also do big demonstrations to challenge and get people to see the absurdity of certain practices, like firewalking. they lay out the coals and they do the firewalking. And then they get other people to do the firewalking and say, look, see, it doesn't require any special magic. Anyone can walk on fire. Now, if you're used to walking around barefoot, as they do a lot in India, and you get calluses on your feet and so on, firewalking isn't such a hard thing. It isn't recommended for Westerners who haven't been walking around barefoot for a couple of weeks. But their demonstrations are very impressive, and I've watched them, and I've watched the firewalking. I would call it fire running to look at it, but they walk rather briskly across those coals. What's interesting is they set that up in some village, and it's kind of amusing to watch the young men of the village try to vie with each other as how courageous they are and how willing they are to walk across the coals. And then the young women start doing it, and they show up the guys. It's just an amazing thing to watch. It's just a big, exciting thing, and all is a high-profile way of getting across their message that you don't need to believe in something supernatural in order to do these things. And they do other demonstrations where they show that it doesn't require magic to accomplish many of these feats that the godmen supposedly are the only ones who can do. And that's part of their democratizing effort. They also perform intercaste marriages. This is a big thing where a lot of people want to marry across caste lines and they're unable to do so. This is the place where they can go and get a legal wedding that way.
Does that mean that there has to be some certification of the person performing the wedding?
Well, and they are appropriately certified. Sometimes they get a government official to perform the wedding. They have good relations with mayors and governors and people like that. So they're actually highly regarded. They don't suffer a lot of hostility in their community because they are such a charitable social service organization. And they work with many of the mainstream charities as well as many of the traditional religious charities. They'll work hand in glove with Catholics and Protestants and everybody else who does the same kind of charitable work because they're all in the same business. And they don't require that anyone give up their religious beliefs in order to benefit from what they have to offer, but they do offer it. They do say, well, if you want to consider, you know, we do have these other ideas, but they don't make accepting their ideas or even listening to a talk they have to offer as a condition of getting the benefits. So it's not like listen to a 3-hour sermon and then you'll get your bowl of soup and your towel and washcloth, like they do in some of the rescue missions in inner cities in the United States. This is a case where they just offer the help anyway, but as an adjunct to that, they have these various educational and entertainment programs that you can participate in if you want to. And by entertainment programs, I mean they're really big into Indian classical dance. And the dances of India have a lot of symbolism, and it's sort of like the different movements are words and tell stories. So what they do is they use all of the motions and movements of Indian classical dance to tell humanist stories, to express different ideas. They talk about evolution through the dance. They talk about having ethics without God and all sorts of things. Anything that they want to talk about, they use social issues, and these dances express the ideas that they're trying to get across. So they have classes in classical dance.
Are there Hindu versions of evolution or creationism that are taken literally by the followers?
Well, Hinduism is more or less compatible, as is Buddhism and Jainism, with the idea of evolution. They don't have a real problem with it. They just mean a whole lot more by it. They mean you go through a series of past lives and all of that. So they add on all this extra stuff, but they don't have a problem with evolution per se. So that isn't a big issue. But when they talk about evolution in their classical dance, it's more to promote kind of a scientific view of evolution, kind of strip it of all of the mythology and all of the God characters and so on, and just present it as purely natural.
Now, what was the name of this atheist group again?
It's called the Atheist Center, and it's in Vijayawada, India. And it's the biggest show in town.
And did you visit that place on more than one of your trips?
On every one of my trips. Okay. I bring people there because it's just quite a program, and all of the work that they do to help people is so astounding that our tour groups often raise money amongst ourselves, and we make a big donation at the end to their work because it's so impressive.
Mm-hmm. Do they work with the Dalits?
They do indeed. Their effort to remove the that status of outcast and undercast is important, and so their intercaste marriages oftentimes involve bringing Dalits into relationships with people who are outside that. And it's an interesting argument to listen to Indians talk about the whole Dalit thing, because in one sense, because it's the outcast group, and therefore they're technically not a caste, they're kind of a non-caste. Mm. So the argument runs from some Indians that they're not really Hindus because they're outcast. But then if you say, well, does that mean anyone who's a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, that they're also a Dalit? Well, no, not really. So, but it's easy to see how the Dalits themselves aren't getting much out of Hinduism. That's for sure. They're on the bottom of the ladder.
So are they more likely to convert to Christianity?
They're more likely to convert to anything that gives them any kind of respect. They've converted to Buddhism. They've converted to atheism, all sorts of things that they will do, to a humanist outlook, because it gets them out of that class and that category. And there's no way to tell, by the way, by looking at somebody, what caste they belong to. Once upon a time, that would have been the case, that certain traits tended to be characterized due to inbreeding in various of the castes. Mm. But that's less and less today, so that if someone leaves their caste and moves to another part of India, and particularly if they're married to someone from another caste, then they just blend into society, and who would know? And therefore, they're really big at the Atheist Center and among humanists in other parts of India as well, as promoting intercaste marriages.
What other parts of India did you spend time in?
I went to Hyderabad, where they had a humanist group there. I went to South India. In South India is where you have the organizations that continue the work of Periyar. Periyar was an activist who organized the people of South India, because they're Dravidians, they're darker skinned. In fact, they're dark-skinned Caucasians. Many of them are darker than American black people, but they're essentially Caucasians. They're the earliest group that was in India before the Aryan invasion at much later times that brought in the Vedic culture. So part of the argument of the Dravidian movement of Periyar is that they were going to liberate themselves from a Hinduism that had basically treated them like second-class citizens. That while Indians may generally deny that darker-skinned peoples in India are in any way discriminated against, you can see it in all of the advertising, who is the models for the advertising. You can see it in who are the lead actors in their movies, and they have a very vigorous movie industry.
Bollywood.
Bollywood is the largest movie industry in the world.
Really?
And, yeah, they make more movies than anybody else. More of them are lousier than anybody else because they're just churned out one after another. And then they have to release them in multiple languages because India is a multilingual country. Get a piece of Indian rupee money and it has the denomination written in every single one of the different scripts that's major in the country. And so the bills are just full of words, each line in a different Indian language, all of them equally unreadable to me. And therefore, they have to release these movies in multiple language versions, or to make or have the actors speak all of their parts instead of dubbing them in all of these different languages. So that's just a tremendously large movie industry. But you find the main movie stars are all lighter skinned. And the real telling case was the Miss India contest. I not only did I read some articles in the newspapers about how the Miss India contest tended to focus on women who had Western traits, were tall and slender and had lighter skin and lighter hair and so on, But when I looked online at all the past winners of the Miss India contest over the years, these were the most European-looking Indians that I'd seen. So clearly that's the tendency. There are strong efforts to deny it, but when you talk to the people at the Atheist Center, they're more willing to acknowledge it and say, yes, it's true, there is a discrimination, and that's what the Periyar movement was in part based on, is that we're not going to be an underclass.
You've probably seen Slumdog Millionaire.
Yes.
Were there things that called back memories?
There were a few things that called back memories there, and there were things in there that I had not witnessed. And a lot of Indians object to the film because it's such an exaggeration of Indian life. Like, there's the one scene where the Hindu militants charge in and do murder and mayhem in a Muslim village, like as though this just happens every day and it's causeless. Well, something like that did happen, but it was a particular political event. But the way it's depicted in the movie, it's like this kind of thing happens all the time, and it really doesn't. These are very rare and specialized things that do occur. I mean, there are religious riots where people are killed. These things do happen. But to present it like it was a commonplace is not the best way. So there were many aspects of it that caused many Indians to object. But the film itself is really a standout and interesting work of art. And to me, the thing that brought it home to me was the exaggeration inherent in the Slumdog and his brother engaging in a tour of the Taj Mahal, and they just kind of made up all of this foolishness about the Taj Mahal and talked these tourists through it in order to make a little money on the side. And you'll find all sorts of people, maybe not that extreme. I mean, I never saw anything quite like that, and I don't think there is anything quite like that, but it exaggerates the situation where there are all sorts of people out there trying to make a buck, doing whatever they can with the tourist trade, and oh, I'll take you on a tour of this, or I'll tell you about that. And this is true all over the world, actually. You get the same kind of thing in the Holy Land. You visit Israel, and oh yeah, there are plenty of people who are just going to tell you everything you want to hear about, oh, this is where Jesus walked, and so on. And they know no such thing. Mark Twain, in A Tramp Abroad, made a joke about his travels in Europe and all of the phony tour guides he ran into there back in the late 1800s. And in one case, he says, so I went into this one museum, and they showed a skull, and they said, this is the skull of Julius Caesar. And then they showed another skull and said, this is the skull of Julius Caesar when he was a little boy. So in that sense, Slumdog Millionaire resonated for me, but it isn't unique to India, that sort of thing.
Looking at the different trips you've made to India over the years, do you see any changes or progress for humanists in India?
Well, the progress for humanism in India really got underway when India broke away from Britain, because Nehru, for example, the first prime minister of India, was a humanist. And humanism is actually mentioned in the Indian constitution, that it is the duty of the government to promote humanism and the scientific temper. That's built into the constitution. Now, a lot of things are in the constitution, and so some people disregard that, but the humanists in India are fond of quoting that and saying, therefore, it is our patriotic duty to promote these values and ideals, because it was the intellectuals who were behind the organized effort to liberate India from British colonial control. And the founder of the Atheist Center, whose name was Gora, he was a friend of Mohandas Gandhi, and he and Gandhi had dialogues on the subject of atheism, and he encouraged Gandhi to become more tolerant of the atheist idea, and the whole discussion between them is published in a pamphlet that is made available by the Atheist Center, that they have the They recorded their dialogue, and so the full text of Gora's dialogue with Gandhi on atheism is right there. And in the end, Gandhi sort of comes around and says, well, you know, atheists can be wonderful people too, and all this. So he wasn't prepared to adopt the view himself, but nonetheless, it was part of Gandhi's tolerance to have this kind of wide-ranging idea that that virtuous people could be found everywhere. And the Gandhian movement is something very strongly identified with by many atheists in India and humanists.
Do you think you'll make any more trips to India?
I don't have any in the offing. I would love to go back and visit, but I just don't have any opportunities on the horizon that are making it look like I'm going to go back. But I maintain the friendships of the people there, and whenever any of them are coming to this country, I arrange to have them speak at various humanist and other groups and speak at conferences and things like that. And I've certainly moderated panel discussions in which various of the people talk about their various social programs in India. And it's quite impressive to humanists in this country, because we have to put up with evangelicals saying to us, well, where are the humanist hospitals? Where are the humanist charities and food kitchens and so on? Well, there's a bunch of them in India. that's where they are. Mm-hmm. And during the Asian tsunami many years ago, not that many, a few years ago, the American Humanist Association's Project Humanist Charities connected with the Atheist Center in Vijayawada to get money raised by American humanists to India in the hands of Indian humanists, who would then provide the relief and expend the money. So it wasn't just humanists raising money and then, say, giving it to the Red Cross. This was a case of humanists raising money and then giving it to a humanist charitable organization that was doing it down on the ground. So it was humanists all the way down. And it was just great. It was very gratifying to many Americans who contributed, and Europeans as well, who contributed to that effort during the Asian tsunami. And something very similar was done during the earthquake in Pakistan and Kashmir. And we had someone on the ground there who was with one of the universities there, and they went and built new housing and things like that with money raised through humanist charities. That's essentially the preferred way to work. And the same thing happened in Haiti during the Haitian situation. We had a person from Dominican Republic who was able to actually corral a gunboat and get all of the supplies that American donors had paid for onto the gunboat, because there were plenty of people engaged in piracy during that time. We were going to try to take anything you had if you were trying to take it to rescue anyone. And he managed to corral a gunboat and got the materials on there. And the humanists were the first aid agency into Hakmel in Haiti, into that town, because people were talking about Port-au-Prince and, you know, the things that were high profile. And humanists try to look for places where no help is being given, and mm-hmm. and fill holes in the gaps. I mean, fill up the gaps and mm-hmm. fill in the holes.
Right. Hmm. Well, that's very interesting. Thank you very much, Fred, for being interviewed for our radio program.
I was happy to do it.
Good.